Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 286. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, stroll on over to the Facebook, type in thisshowisogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you, approaching 5,000 people there, so join them. A happy Thanksgiving week to you all, and what a special show we have for you this week. One of my goals in starting this show 7 years ago was to feature just a ton of different voices, and while it has been so incredible featuring the singer-songwriters and actors and executive directors of our LGBT organizations, one of the things I had originally set out to do was to feature the voices of people I have encountered along my own journey through this life. It's been a really long time since I've been able to do that, and I'm just plain thrilled that I get to do it again this week. Back in June, while working on AIDS Life Cycle, I met the Reverend Eileen Brownell. It was an emotional first meeting, which I'll tell you about a little later, and it had a very happy ending, which you will also hear about. It was such a joy seeing her every day and hearing a bit about her story, and I knew then that I wanted you listeners to hear about her own journey. It took us so many months to finally come together, but here we are on a week of Thanksgiving, which feels quite fitting. Reverend Eileen, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh, thank you, Ken. It's great to be here with you.
So much to chat about. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let me just get this part out of the way so that I don't have to worry about it anymore. How's the weather in California?
Well, I live in Northern California. It's not Southern. But right now it's 58 degrees outside.
Okay.
So it's dropping down, however, into the 40s at night. So you can still be envious a little bit.
Yeah. This concludes our interview with the Reverend Eileen Brownell. Because it's kind of miserable here in the Cleveland right now, but that's okay. We still will chat. All right. So as I told you off the air, I hired a private investigator, so I know all about you. So this is what I've learned. You tell me if things are true or not, okay?
Okay. All right.
Born and raised in Chico, California and Portland, Maine.
Correct.
I know nothing about Chico, California. I love Portland, Maine, though.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's where I went to high school.
That's where I do. So I used to do, and I need to get back to it, they do a Montreal to Portland, Maine AIDS ride. And Portland, Maine, for folks who don't know it, what a lovely place in the country.
It's beautiful there. If it wasn't for the snow, I'd probably continue to live there.
Yes.
I don't like shoveling snow anymore.
So instead, you went back to Orange County, and you worked for numerous community services departments. Is that right?
That's correct.
I'm not even sure I know what that means.
I got my degree, or my Bachelor of Arts degree, in Recreation Administration.
Oh.
And a community services department is a combination of recreation, parks, human services, senior services, just depends upon the community in which you work.
Love it.
And so Chico is about 90 miles north of Sacramento, and of course wanting to break the umbilical cord with my parents because they lived here in Chico, I got in my little VW 2 days after graduation and headed for the land of plenty. And so I lived in Long Beach and Orange County and worked for 5 different cities in Southern California before I returned to Chico in the early 90s.
Okay. And in the interim, you've taught, and I love this part about your background, you've taught at the college level for quite some time.
Yeah, I taught at Cal State Long Beach, and then I've taught at 3 community colleges in Southern California and Northern California.
Okay. All right. So I'm getting it all right so far.
Yes, you are.
All right. Let's keep going. So in the early 90s, you returned to Chico to be with your parents.
Correct. That's right.
And it is there that you discovered religious science.
That's right. My gosh, you're good.
I can find out anything about anyone, listeners. Please know that right now. I can discover stuff about you. Talk to me about religious science and what drew you there.
Well, when I returned to Chico, I returned to the church in which I was born and raised, and I had a challenge with one of 2 ministers there. He was not fond of my sexual orientation. And so he and I had a confrontation, and I told Mother and Dad, I said, I'm not sitting at the back of the bus anymore. I'm done with that, because I had lost my job in Southern California because of my sexual orientation. And so I left the church and I started exploring and went to several different ones, and several friends kept saying, you need to go to religious science, you need to go to the Church of Religious Science. And what was very unique or unusual was I soon discovered that actually I had kind of danced with the spirituality since the mid-80s, because several friends in Southern California had tried to get me to go to a church in Huntington Beach that was religious science. And then when my brother was diagnosed with HIV, he began to work with what he called this woman, and he said, she prays for me, but yet they don't call it prayer.
Mm.
And in religious science, we call it treatment. And it's a very specific five-step process that we do, affirming that what we choose to create in our life has already been created. And we also affirm our oneness with the divine. And so in the process of when he was dying, I happened to meet the woman because she ended up doing my brother's memorial service. And I still didn't know what religious science was. And so I really kind of danced with that spirituality for a very long time. And then when my friends finally got me to begin going to the church in 01, it was like, this is home. I know where I belong. And I got on the fast track to become a minister.
Wow. So for gay Jews from New York like me, who need the primer on religious science, how do you explain it to people?
Well, the way I typically explain it is that our founder's name was Ernest Holmes.
Okay.
And back in the turn of the century and on into the early 20s, he was doing a tremendous amount of research on a lot of religions. And he was originally a Congregationalist. And I always akin it a little bit to, if you look at a quilt that's on a bed or hanging on a wall, you know that there's several different squares. And each square has a very specific pattern, and it matches all the other squares on it. But it might be different colors. So one square might be basically blues, another one might be basically red materials, another one yellow materials. But the pattern is all the same.
Yeah.
And what Ernest Holmes discovered was that in all religions throughout the world, that there was a real specific similarity in how they approached spirit. And he went through and found that common thread that was in all religions, and then went ahead and began lecturing about it. And before too long, people kept saying, oh, you have to start this church. You have to start the church. And our beliefs, for example, are, we look at the quote in the Bible that says, you know, the kingdom of God is within. We believe that God is not a God in the sky, but that our God is actually one with us and lives and resides within us. And we don't, when we pray, we don't beseech God. We don't reach out to a God and say, oh, God in heaven, please do this for me. We affirm that we are one with God, and affirm that what it is that we're choosing to create within our life has already transpired and already happening.
Wow.
So it's really a wonderful spirituality. I love it. I'm obviously, being a minister in it, I'm totally engrossed in it. And I've watched how it has changed so many lives, because so many people have such a belief about God, or, you know, that is contrary to what really God is.
Now, it strikes me, given that description and given that you were on this show with So Gay, it strikes me that religious science pretty okay with the gays then.
Oh, absolutely. Numerous ones of, you know, several of our ministers are gays or lesbians. And it's a very open. We were doing unions long before it was, you know, marriage came around. We were doing, our ministers were doing unions for gays and lesbians.
Nice.
And so, yeah, we're very, very supportive of the gay and lesbian community.
Well, so somewhere in there, and you've mentioned it, you made this decision to become ordained. It strikes me that that was probably a big decision.
Well, you know, I always love to tell the story, ordination is part of our journey. But I always tell the story when people say, "Well, when did you know you were going to be a minister?" And when I was in the first grade, my first grade teacher, Miss Cleek, said to us, "Today, boys and girls, in sharing, we're going to share what we want to be when you grow up." And so she got to me and she said, "Eileen, what are you going to be?" And I said, "I'm going to be a minister." And she said, "Very interesting."
Wow.
And I remember this was about 1951, 52. And when women were not ministers, they were ministers of education, but they were not ministers of churches. And I had this magazine, my family always got Life magazine, and long about 55 or 56, this magazine came out with an article about a Presbyterian minister that was a woman. And I saved that magazine. I just coveted that magazine.
Wow.
And the wonderful thing about it was also that my mom and dad, when people would say, "Eileen can't be a minister, she's not a man," my mother and dad would say, "If she wants to be a minister, she can do that." And that lasted until I was into my teens, and then of course I went away to college and I picked my career and I went along the way. And along about my 30s, I took out papers for a seminary in Southern California and never quite submitted it because it never felt right. And when I lost my job when I was in my mid-40s, I thought, this is what Spirit's telling me to do, is to go become a minister. And so I took out the paperwork from Berkeley Theology Seminary. And again, I didn't submit it because it didn't feel right. And so when I ended up in my mid-50s at a Church of Religious Science, it was like, oh yeah, this is where I belong. And now we call ourselves Centers for Spiritual Living.
Love it.
And so we start out on a path where we become licensed first after our educational process. We become licensed, and then after so many years, we become ordained. So I was licensed originally in 07 and ordained, or 06 rather, and ordained in 2011.
So let's do the two sides of the coin. Let's start with the good. The most fulfilling part about being a reverend for you.
The things that I love to do the most is pastoral care. And pastoral care is working with people who are in major challenges in their life. They're ill. They're dying. I also am a police chaplain for the local police department, and which requires that I go into situations where a loved one has died, and
yeah,
I'm the one that goes in with the police officer and notifies the family, or I'm called in where there's suicides to deal with family members who have found the individual after they've killed themselves. And so that's the work that I just really feel called to, is chaplaincy. Of course, I always also love counseling and speaking on Sundays, but who doesn't? And I think I feel strongly that once you become a minister, you never really stop being a minister until the day that you transition. So,
yeah,
that's the best part, is working with people in the difficult and the challenging times.
See, for me, in that answer, I feel like those would be some of my answers for the second half of the question, which is, what has been the most challenging for you? Because some of those situations, I think there's something to be said that there are temperaments that maybe particularly prevail in doing that work that you just described capably. I don't think, which is all to say, I don't think I could do some of what you just said.
Well, I think when it becomes a challenge is when you're backed up with several situations. And just a summer ago, I also serve on the county critical incident stress management team, which means that there's a group of psychotherapists and ministers and first responders, representatives from police and fire departments within our county, that when something major happens that is a challenge for the first responders, we go in within 24 to 48 hours afterwards and debrief them. Example being, I'm sure you heard about last summer's or last May's bus and Federal Express fire.
Yes.
I was on the team that went in, and We worked with over 60 first responders to debrief them so they don't end up with post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Wow.
And so a year ago, I was called into a situation where it was a car fire with bodies in the car fire. And so we worked with the police, and within about a week or 10 days, then there was a shooting where a police officer had, you know, was attacked by somebody who was high on drugs, and there was a shooting. So we debriefed that team. And within probably a few days after that, I was called into the hospital where a five-week-old child had been killed.
Wow.
And so I was dealing with the family in that situation. And I knew at the end of that, Ken, that I had reached my limit. And
yeah.
So I went back to the police department and I said, don't call me, I'll call you. And I went to my mentor and sat down and talked about it, because I was at that point where too many pictures and too many things were happening within me, and I knew that I couldn't be effective if I didn't take care of me first.
Hey, look at that, healthy boundaries. I try to teach my students that. I'm not always successful, but it really, I don't think we could ever overestimate how important those healthy boundaries are, because you can't help other people when you're in that triggered place, when you're in that place where you feel like, oh gosh, I've reached a wall.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. All right, listeners, again, we are here with the Reverend Eileen Brownells. Let's bring us up to date. So at some point, I would assume in the past year, you decided, all right, I'm sprightly. I'm going to get on a bike, and I'm going to bike, you know, hundreds of miles for AIDS Life Cycle. How did that decision come about?
Well, in 2013, I was at our church conference. And there was another minister there who was riding his bicycle around the conference grounds, which happens to be right on the Pacific Ocean. And I overheard him talking to a group of women and saying that he, you know, did the AIDS life cycle every summer. And you know, how much he loved it, and that in 14 it was going to be his eighth year. And so I saw him later on the campus, and I said, you know, just call me. I'd be glad to support your effort, because I've lost three members of my family to the disease. And he said, do the AIDS life cycle. And I just said, I don't even own a bicycle. I haven't ridden since I was in college. And he just kept looking at me going, do the ride. And I said, you know, do you realize how old I am? You know, I'm like 68 years old. You want me to do this? He said, do the ride. And so he just kept hounding me. So I came home, and after a couple of weeks of prayer, decided that Spirit really was nudging me in that direction, and so ended up taking about $2,000 out of the savings account and bought the bicycle, bought the shoes, bought the special padded pants, you know, and all the gear that you've got to do. And so for 9 months, instead of walking the dogs 5 and 6 mornings a week, I got on my bicycle and rode my bicycle. And my goal initially was to, I have to tell you this story because it's so incredible. I said that I was going to raise $5,000 for the AIDS ride. And so, and as you know, Ken, they require that we raise at least $3,000.
Yes.
So I put it out there, and of course, you know, $10 here and $30 there, and a little money started to kind of dribble in. And one day I was speaking with my spiritual mentor, and I happened to say, I said, I don't know where my head was. I can't raise $5,000, let alone will I ever raise $3,000. I'm going to have to contribute to do this. And my mentor said, are you getting in God's way, Eileen? And well, life just absolutely stopped me cold. And 2 days later, I received a card or a check in the mail with a note to it, and it was from a woman that she and her sister and my brother and I there was about 4 years age difference between all four of us, and we were like this little brat pack at the church, and our families did a lot together. And she sent me the note, and she said, Eileen, I didn't know your uncle or your cousin, but I did know Kenny, and that was my brother's name was Kenneth, and we called him Kenny. And she said, so I honor him by contributing to your AIDS ride. And I opened up the check, Ken, and it was a check for $2,000.
I can't hear this story. That's unbelievable.
And I just sat there and started to cry. And the next day, I was notified by the AIDS Life Cycle website or whatever that someone else had contributed $1,000.
Oh, my gosh.
And so within less than 48 hours, I had raised the initial $3,000 that I needed. And as it progressed, I got the 5,000 and I just kept going. So I raised my limit to 10,000 and I was able to raise $9,000 through 65 people. And it was so, after my mentor said to me, are you getting in God's way? It just became very clear to me that I just needed to step back and get out of the way and let Spirit do the work. And so that's what I did.
All right. Oh, gosh. All right. We have so much to talk about. I don't even know where to go next. Let's start with the physical piece. Let's get that part out of the way. Your goal was to ride. I remember you telling me you wanted to pedal 270 miles, and there were a few points where you were expressing some doubt that you would be able to pull off 270 miles over those 7 days. What was your grand total?
My grand total was, I think it was like 340. My goal was to do 50% of the ride. And so every day I really put out the effort to do 50%, and I was kind of amazed when I could go beyond that. So the ride itself was 545, and I made 339, 340, 342, something like that. And so I met the halfway mark for myself for the 50% and then went beyond that by a few miles.
I was going to say, I didn't want this to be a revelation for you now many months later that you do know that you went over the halfway point, but you know that.
Yes.
That's good.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Now, do I highlight, as you already have, but how important is it to highlight that you, at the time, 69 years old, riding 340 miles?
It was pretty incredible for me, and I have to say that long about Monday, Sunday was just kind of this real high for me.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the crowd's there, everybody's cheering you on, you're on your way, and by Monday was when I started to really get into the fact that I had established a covenant about it and knew that this journey was about love and that it was about faith for me. And meeting people such as yourself, Ken, and sharing stories with men who had been HIV since the mid-80s, and here they were walking around doing great, and yet I had lost three members of my family from 87 to 93, it just tore at my heartstrings, and I literally cried every single day of that ride from Monday on, as well as probably about a month after the ride, I was still crying because stuff just kept coming up. And I remembered, for me living in Southern California and my brother living in Eugene, Oregon, I initially, when the disease hit, a lot of people were so fearful that they were going to catch the disease by touch. And
yeah.
So a lot of us as lesbians stepped up and collected food. We took people to doctor's appointments. We did what was ever necessary. And just before my brother died, I had a staff member in the city that I was working for refuse to touch me because I had bathed my brother. And he said, I will get the disease.
Wow.
And this was days after I had been in Eugene, Oregon, and had assisted my brother. And so, you know, that those recollections of prejudice and then making it up a huge mountain, you know, like the, what was it, the twin sisters that we, or whatever, the evil sisters.
The evil twins, yes.
The evil twins, I guess, yeah. You know, making it up those mountains. By the time I got to that point where we were halfway through the ride, I just stood there and cried. I couldn't believe that I had made it up the evil twins. I couldn't believe that I had made it halfway through the ride. So the trip was extremely emotional for me. And, of course, not only did I lose my brother, my uncle,
yeah,
and my cousin, but I probably lost, in the early days of the disease, through church memberships and organizations I belonged to, about 20 friends.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to keep their Rolodex cards because that was like the way I could prove that they lived.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Well, we have more to talk about with that, too. But first, let me bring you back.
Okay.
AIDS Life Cycle 2014. It is day four. It is lifeguard day for us. It was our little beach day on the gear and tent. I'm just sitting there. My two fellow roadies on my truck, Tom and Cody, went off to go do something. This woman comes up to me, slightly distraught, telling me that she can't find her wallet.
That's right.
This was you.
That's right.
You were doing the physical exhaustion piece, I can only imagine, and obviously you had all this emotional stuff going on, and here you were, and you couldn't find your wallet. Now, I didn't tell you this, because, you know, you came over, and we kind of looked around, and we couldn't find it, but I was hoping, you know, we were going to have some faith, and your wallet was going to turn up. Do you know what happened when you walked away?
I believe you started to cry.
I did.
Yeah.
I called my mother. I just said, you know what? I don't even really know why. I think we were all raw at that point.
Yeah.
And I didn't want you to have that one thing that was distracting you in any way. And just you got to me in that moment in a really beautiful way. Obviously, it's even more beautiful because it had a happy ending. Did you indeed find your wallet?
Yes, I
exactly.
did. I put it someplace where I hadn't looked. And, you know, ding dong. but it had ended up in a side pocket in my little iPad case. And I hadn't discovered that at all. And I had looked. I had torn my whole bag apart. I had gone through my bicycle. I had gone everywhere. And, of course, what I don't think I told you, but 2 days after that, my phone fell off my bike.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was also found. So it was like lost and found. Here we are. And that was kind of like how I was feeling on the trip. I was lost and now I'm found.
Gosh. I felt in that moment it was as close to pastoral care as I've ever done. Just want to put that out there. So what I was kind of hoping, if you're okay with it, I would love for you to tell our listening audience about Kenny. Because he's got my name, and I know he so inspired you to do some of the work that you do. Will you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. The first story that I always share about my brother is I was born the day after World War II ended, in August of 1945. And that was, of course, back when there was rationing. You know, meat was rationed, butter, milk, materials, everything was, you had to have your little coupon book or ration book to be able to get what you needed. And my mother and dad and my brother lived about six blocks from downtown Chico. And so my mother would walk, because there was gas rationing, she would walk to downtown Chico, and my brother, 4 years old, would walk with her, and they would go down and stand in lines to get whatever it was that they were going for. And people would take mercy on my brother, and they would say, "So, Kenny, what's your mama going to have?" And he'd say, "A baby sister." And they would say, "And so when's she going to be born?" And he'd say, "After the war is over." Now, this is, you know, before, this is like spring of 1945, and he was projecting that, and everybody'd say, "Oh, that's really nice." And I was due the end of July and was actually born August 16th, 1945. And Japan had surrendered August 15th.
Wow.
And so so, and my parents have always told that story, and they've always told the story of how he would stand over my bassinet and sing lullabies and songs to me. And there was this tremendous bond between my brother and I. They're always, you know, they're from the time we were very small. And funny thing about it, my brother was given a train set when he was a boy, and I was given the dolls. And then we would exchange those gifts because I loved his train set and he loved my dolls.
I love it. I love it.
And you know, and he was, and when he was married for 15 or 16 years and had two children. He had a boy and a girl, and when his girl was born, I gave her a softball glove with a softball because that was the big sport that I played. And when his son was born, I gave him a Revere Child's cooking set because that's what Ken loved to do, was to cook. And of course, he and I laughed about that for a very long time, but he was an incredible cook. He was, he loved to do that. He got his degree from the University of New Hampshire, and because we were living in Maine at the time, and he got that in hotel, motel, restaurant management.
Okay.
And he taught at, or he didn't teach, but he worked at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute for 7 years. And he, when he was there, he was not teaching, but he was running the food services within the campus there, and the dormitories and the cafeterias. And he ended up getting married while he was working there. And ultimately, they decided that they wanted to get any place west of the Mississippi. And so they started applying for jobs, and he ended up getting a teaching job because at that point he had a master's. He got a teaching job at Eugene at the community college there, and ultimately owned a couple of restaurants, and his final job was as the front house manager of the Holt Performing Arts Center. And so it brought all of his skills in customer service and food services, and his organizational skills allowed him to do that. And he also loved theater and music on the side. And so he did a lot of amateur acting in plays and stuff like that. And he had two kids who are now 40 and 42, I think it is. And it was just, he finally decided when he was about 15, 16 years into the marriage that he needed to stop walking the picket fence because he needed to be who he was. And he knew exactly who had given him AIDS, and he knew when he had contacted it. Mm-hmm. And he was so responsible about it when they finally discovered what was going on for him and he tested HIV positive. He got on the phone and he called every single individual that he had had relations with and asked them to go get tested. And at the time, Eugene didn't really have any services for individuals that were HIV positive or had AIDS. And so he started literally a rap group for people who had been diagnosed with HIV. And he had such a positive attitude about it. And he got the disease or was infected in December of 83, and he died in December of 91. So back then, to have lasted 8 years when all there was AZT was pretty incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was all because of his determination and, you know, his desire to, you know, he used to say, I'm going to beat this thing. And I really thought that he would be able to do that until the last year of his life. He finally had to go on disability because he was losing so much weight and he was so weak. And he had cyclomegalovirus of his esophagus. And, of course, you know, then it just one opportunistic infection hit after another. So it was difficult to watch, difficult to be part of. And, you know, I'm not sure that we ever totally get over grief. It becomes much less a part of our life but it was extremely difficult for me to lose him because we were so incredibly close.
Yeah. Oh, I so appreciate, though, you bringing him to life for our show. It's such a privilege to even hear about him,
Thank you.
Well, I have some random ephemera for you before we close. Can we do some random ephemera?
You betcha.
All right. So here's some quick things from your life and some quick advice that you're going to give us. You have a text out there. You have all these books out there. One of them, The Awesome Power of You, 131 Affirmations for Success. Can I just get one of them?
Sure. I am healthy, whole, and happy.
I am healthy, whole, and happy. Okay, I want another one.
Another one would be, I am living in abundance every day.
Love it. Love it. Oh, I feel that right now. I feel that one right now. Okay, so that's one. We got three pieces of ephemera. Ephemera number two. Should I ever find myself, by the way, this is never going to happen, but should I ever find myself, let me just put it out there. Let me ruin the ending. Should I ever find myself trout fishing, what tips do you have for me?
Oh, just enjoy the stream. Just enjoy it.
Is that a metaphor? I don't even know what that means.
Well, you know, the fishing is just, it's you and the fish, and you're trying to outsmart that fish, and so it's trying to find the place that they're hiding, and you're casting, and you're putting it out there, and watching the riffles, and getting it to work for you, and it's just such an incredible feeling when that trout goes boom and it hits that line and you're starting to reel that puppy in.
Yeah, I'm going to take your word for it. And ephemera number three, we actually do have a rose bush in our backyard, but we have no idea what we're doing. What do I need to know?
Well, now, because you've already started to snow there,
yes.
Hopefully you've already trimmed it back and covered it with hay and sacks, et cetera. But for me, where it doesn't snow, in January, the third weekend in January, you begin to cut back the roses, and you cut them back to approximately 18 to 20 inches in length.
Okay.
And then you just watch them begin to unfold and rebud in February, March, and by April, you'll have wonderful blooms. I only have about 60 or 65 bushes in my yard.
Okay. Well, let me tell you, I'm going to go out and go buy hay right after I go trout fishing. So that's about when that's going to happen.
Okay, I got it.
Well, let's end on a spiritual note, and I think this is so important. Look, we have talked about religion off and on over the past 6 years, 7 years of doing the show. I would love to get your take on, for our LGBT listeners who haven't been able to connect with a spirituality, with a sense of that spirit, will you give us some guidance?
I'm not sure, Ken, what to share, except that I know that all of us are connected divinely to God, and God doesn't make junk. And I love what my father said. My parents really struggled having two gay children, and they were being interviewed by the Los Angeles Times at one point, an author who was writing an article for the LA Times, and she was quizzing mom and dad about what they felt. And my dad turned around and he said, you know, we finally realized that Eileen and Ken were children of God and that God had created them and that they had a choice to make. And that choice was whether they wanted to be happy in life or not. And he said they chose to be happy because they chose to be who they were. And I think that, you know, that would be the advice or the gem that I would give to everyone. Choose to be who you are. Don't fight it. So many of us struggled with it initially when we were coming out, not understanding or thinking that, you know, spirit didn't like us because of who we were and that we were sinners. And that's not the truth at all. And I'd also tell you that sin, which a lot of people define our sexuality as, actually in ancient Greek times, a sin was when you pulled the bow and arrow back and the arrow missed its mark. That's where the word sin came from, is missing the mark. And we don't miss the mark when we live the life that we were meant to live here on earth.
There it is. There it is. Well, look, did you inspire me when I met you? Absolutely. And just when I met you and when we shared that moment of emotion that ended very well. But then as we got to talking and I got to hear some of your story and heard about your family and heard about what sets you on this path and certainly heard about the work that you do and the care that you put out there in the world, there's no better way to say it than what you just said, is that we are full of these connections. All of these connections are out there. And I just feel so connected to you and am in such awe and have such respect for the energy that you put out there in the world. And truly, in that moment and to this day, you really are a role model for me.
Thank you, Ken. Well, I hope that we continue with our connection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Reverend Eileen, what an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
And I'm delighted. It was an honor to be with you tonight, Ken.
Well, nothing says Thanksgiving as much as me kind of having the flu and not having much of a voice and sitting in a very much non-soundproof room in my sister's house in New Jersey before the Thanksgiving feast is to begin. But we have some time left on this week's show, so you got to suffer through the sound quality and the very much non-soundproof room and hear about some gay news, because there is some gay news out there this week. Well, attention was on Mississippi this week, where another victory for marriage equality has taken place. There's this great piece in The Advocate called Why the Mississippi Marriage Win is Our Most Important Yet. And so you can stroll on over to advocate.com and read all about it, but I wanted to tell you a little bit from that piece. It reads, quote, "The recent victory in Mississippi is more than just a win for equality and fairness. It's proof that marriage equality advocates have locked onto the winning arguments that will persuade courts to overturn bans on same-sex marriage. Last week, attorney Roberta Kaplan presented oral arguments before U.S. District Court Judge Carlton W. Reeves in Mississippi. He questioned her about the logical limits of marriage, what sorts of protection should be covered by the 14th Amendment, and whether federal courts should even be involved in the issue of marriage. And when Reeves delivered his ruling this past week, it was clear that Kaplan's responses were highly influential. Reeves was clearly listening when Kaplan cited the 1967 decision in Loving v. Virginia, where the U.S. Supreme Court overturned bans on interracial marriage. In fact, Kaplan quoted from that decision in his own decision. During oral arguments, Reeves pressed Kaplan on this point. He said, quote, whenever the 14th Amendment was passed, the conception of same-sex marriage wasn't thought about, conceptualized in anything about liberty or anything else. And this article goes on in just really the most amazing ways. Quite a sophisticated piece there in The Advocate. Not that I'm surprised. They run all these great pieces, but this piece, Why the Mississippi Marriage Win is Our Most Important Yet, is a great one. It's a great one. Now, I have been making fun in the past couple weeks that Ohio sits in the minority of states that do not have marriage equality, and we sit next to Mississippi, and we sit next to Arkansas. And now, all of a sudden, we no longer sit next to either of those because it seems that they have marriage equality, and I'm sitting in a state that doesn't. So congratulations to Mississippi, and we'll see what happens with Ohio, hopefully soon enough. Turning our attention to Uganda, a Ugandan lawmaker is hoping to re-gift a homophobic law to the East African nation just in time for Christmas, more than a year after the original Jail the Gays law was first passed, and nearly 4 months after it was overturned by Uganda's Constitutional Court on a technicality. Abdu Latif Sebagala, a legislator on the parliamentary committee charged with drafting a replacement law for the Anti-Homosexuality Act, told newspapers last week that a new anti-gay bill is now ready for a vote. Sebagala said this, quote, "The draft is ready, and we have strengthened the law, especially in areas of promotion and luring children. Next week, we expect to meet the speaker to fix a date for the retabling to Parliament." He then went on to say that the parliamentary committee are eager to pass the bill within weeks so that the country, quote, can celebrate it as a Christmas gift. Again, they hope to pass this bill, which will punish gays quite severely, probably with jail time, hopefully not with execution, but they want to pass it in the next couple of weeks so that the country, quote, can celebrate it as a Christmas gift. Yeah. So that's what's happening in Uganda. I would like to remind folks, sure, I've been to Uganda a few times, but you don't need to go to learn about Uganda and to learn that this is not one of their most important issues. The roads are in horrible disrepair. HIV and AIDS rates are skyrocketing. There is so much work to be done in Uganda. But the Christmas gift that Abdu Latif Sebagala would like to provide to his country would be an Anti-Homosexuality Act. Merry Christmas to Uganda. Now, on the other side of the equation, I love this piece. Rob and Linda Robertson did what they believed was expected of them as good Christians. When their 12-year-old son Ryan said that he was gay, they told him they loved him, but he had to change. Ryan then entered reparative therapy, met regularly with his pastor, and immersed himself in Bible study and his church youth group. After 6 years, nothing changed. A despondent Ryan, cut off from his parents and his faith, started taking drugs in 2009 and died of an overdose. Rob Robertson, the father, a firefighter for more than 30 years who lives in Redmond, Washington, said this, quote, "Now we realize we were so wrongly taught. It's a horrible, horrible mistake the church has made." The tragedy could have easily driven the Robertsons from the church, but instead of breaking with the evangelical church, as many parents in similar circumstances have done, the couple is taking a different approach, and they're inspiring other Christians with gay children to do the same. They are staying in the church and, in protesting what they see as the demonization of their sons and daughters, they are now presenting a new challenge to Christian leaders trying to hold off growing acceptance of same-sex relationships. Linda Robertson, the mother, said this, quote, "Parents don't have anyone on their journey to reconcile their faith and their love for their child. They either reject their child and hold on to their faith, or they reject their faith and hold on to their child. Rob and I think you can do both. Be fully affirming of your faith and fully hold on to your child." That's from a piece called Evangelicals with Gay Children Challenging Church. It's an AP story by AP religion writer Rachel Zoll, and you should go check it out. Just go Google it, because there's a lot more to this piece. And it's all about this idea that you don't necessarily have to leave that evangelical side of the church if your child comes out gay, nor do you have to break all ties with your gay. There are parents within the evangelical church, which has not been a friend to the LGBT community traditionally, but there are parents in there who are trying to stay with their faith and try to change it from within. That's pretty exciting. We don't want to just cover stories where it's like evangelicals bad, because that's not the case. There are people within the evangelical church who espouse many different views And that's not necessarily what they think. So there are people trying to change it from the inside. Very exciting. Very exciting. Now we turn over to the very distinctly anti-LGBT group National Organization for Marriage. Well, they have now seen a 50% drop in earnings from last year, 2013, compared to 2012, according to their tax filings, which were released this past week. The tax filings indicate that two donors, were responsible for half of the group's $5.1 million in earnings, and that the group ended the year more than $2.5 million in debt. They have seen a 50% drop. And we can only expect that the National Organization for Marriage will just be going under. I mean, they basically said, yeah, this is inevitable at this point. It doesn't mean that they agree with marriage equality, far from it, but they have lost their sting more than a bit. On the other side of marriage, we have, of course, divorce. Well, two divorce attorneys in Washington, D.C. say they've handled a number of cases involving same-sex spouses who are seeking divorces in states that don't recognize their marriages. This is a quote from Washington divorce attorney Cody Silva. He said, quote, "It's a very unfortunate predicament to be in because you realize you cannot get divorced in your state of residence, and the state you are married in will not allow you to get divorced unless you go back and essentially become a resident of that state," end quote. So the question now is, which should not surprise anyone, is same-sex divorce the next hurdle for equality? I mean, that's one of the big questions. Gosh, how crazy would it be if a state like Ohio, where I live, not sitting there now, right now I'm sitting in a very non-soundproof room in Montvale, New Jersey. What happens if a state like Ohio, which does not have marriage equality, passes first some sort of same-sex divorce bill where they say, okay, we're not yet ready to recognize marriage equality, but we also don't want people who are still married who don't want to be together to allow to be divorced. So Ohio could become one of those 15 or 16 states that does not allow marriage equality, that allows equality of divorce. What do you even call that? I guess you call that divorce equality. Oh my gosh, that's going to be the next thing, divorce equality. And in fact, in a country where a sizable number of marriages end in divorce, I never remember the number. It's not like 50%, is it? It's pretty high. So yeah, it should not be surprising that this is going to be the next hurdle when so many marriages end in divorce. Then we need divorce equality. And you can't just force people to go back to their state. They don't want to go back there. That might be where the other partner is. This is not very pro-Thanksgiving talk that I'm providing right now. You should be with your families and celebrating families. Instead, you're hearing me on very strong drugs talk about divorce equality. But yeah, that's going to be important. It's yet another piece of the puzzle for LGBT folks to be treated exactly the same as their brothers and sisters who are paying taxes. It's kind of important. And finally, we would be remiss if we did not mention Ferguson and all the turmoil that is happening. It has been particularly sharp here in Cleveland. I mean, it's sharp everywhere, but in Cleveland, if you did not hear, we did have the shooting death of a 12-year-old just a few days before the non-indictment of the police officer was handed down in Ferguson. And there are any number of LGBT-related stories which are quite fascinating. You know, I want to be a little bit careful here in not drawing too close of linkages, but there's one piece that I think you guys should check out. It's over on SheWired.com. It's by Victoria Brownworth. It's called "We Are All Ferguson Now." I will read you a little bit of it. "In the aftermath of the stunning verdict in the Ferguson, Missouri case of police officer Darren Wilson and the unarmed black teenager Michael Brown, whom he shot to death on August 9th, millions of Americans have been galvanized to respond. We are still at war in Afghanistan. Last week, the Obama administration quietly announced, to almost no media fanfare, that it was continuing that war when it was supposed to be ending it at the beginning of next year. President Obama is also sending more troops back into Iraq. This too was met by a shrug with Americans. The breadth of the protests versus the crickets over Afghanistan and Iraq make it clear that the real war America is fighting, the one that many of us feel threatened by, is the fight between marginalized communities and law enforcement. the real war for a huge swath of Americans and their allies is the war against a militarized police force that often sees status, race, ethnicity, class, sexual orientation, gender identity before it sees human beings. And it really is an amazing piece. I'll read you one more section from that. LGBT people have a long history of conflict with police as well, although most of these conflicts have resulted in harassment, arrest, and occasional beatings rather than outright killing. But that history cannot be ignored, and there are many members of our community who are in more than one marginalized group, notably LGBT people of color. This is an issue for our community because police harassment of LGBT people is decades old. It was the foundation for the Stonewall Rebellion that spawned our modern LGBT rights movement, and it continues to arise when LGBT people are victims of crime. Are our cases treated with the same concern and attention as those of straight Americans, or is there a tacit belief that we are somehow complicit in the violence that is often perpetrated against us? Again, so much more in that piece. It is called We Are All Ferguson Now. The piece is written by Victoria Brownworth. You can find it over on SheWired.com, and it details what happens for people at risk for injury or death by cop just by virtue of who they are, not anything they have or might have done. Op-ed, We Are All Ferguson Now. And that, my friends, concludes all the time we have for you on this week's episode of This Show Is So Gay. Our thanks, of course, to the Reverend Eileen Brownell. What an absolute pleasure having her on the show. She so inspires me, and my hope is that she inspired you as well. Regardless of how you feel about religious science, and quite frankly, I didn't really know anything about it before I talked to the Reverend, it's all about one woman who has bucked any number of trends, who has found her faith in a world where faith and sexual orientation are sadly mutually exclusive, and who came on our show to bring her brother to life for those of us who didn't know him. What a treat hearing about him, and really what an honor. So our thanks to the Reverend Eileen Brownell. My wishes for you all of just the most amazing Thanksgiving. I hope that you take the time to express gratitude to all of those around you to whom you feel that gratitude. And please know that if for some reason you're not feeling it from everyone, which you should because you're all amazing, know that you feel it from me, that you take the time to listen to this show even when the sound quality is as bad as this week and when I'm feeling as crappy as I am this week. Please know that I am overwhelmed by gratitude that you all take the time to listen, that you send emails, that you make guest suggestions, that you do everything that is that you do to use your voice to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters, even if it's just becoming more informed, which, as we know, most people do not take the time to do. I'm so appreciative that you take the time to do it. Really and truly, a happy Thanksgiving to all of you out there. Get out there, continue to use your voice, express gratitude the way that you want to express it, however that is. And please remember, during this Thanksgiving, why be gay when you can be so gay?